Hello and welcome. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. We've got Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals with Timmy D coming up in just a little bit. We've got a really grim story for you tonight. A Slayer Waits, the true story of a Michigan double murder. And joining us tonight, Rod Sadler. He was with us on Darkness Radio with True Crime Tuesday. And we're going to try to dig up that episode to make it available here as kind of a bonus episode in the next couple of weeks. So you'll be able to hear his original interview and today's interview about his brand new book. Rod is a 30-year veteran police officer, having grown up in the small town of Williamston, Michigan. And having retired back in 2012, he and his wife, Terry, live in the Lansing area with their three children, Alex, Austin, and Andy. He's here with us this evening. We're going to talk about the new book. It's great to have you back with us, Rod. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me, Dave. I'm really excited.
All right. Now, as a cop, and I want to just kind of paint the picture for people as well, you know, there's a lot going on in the world right now. Police have got not a great name. I think you know that because of what's going on around the world and in the United States and elsewhere with law enforcement. When you, as a retired police officer, watch what's happening, is this an escalation? Are there more dark things going on with police officers now, or has there always been an underlying problem? It's just never been really addressed until everybody has a camera on their phone.
Well, I think there's always been this issue. If you look back over the years, I think it has become more prevalent because everybody does have a phone and a camera, and they want to be the ones to get the big story out there. They want to show their video on CNN or NBC or whoever, and it has become more prevalent. It's easier for people. And I think the situation, while it's always been there, you just see more of it today.
You know, and we talk about the violence, the escalation and violence that's going on with law enforcement. And boy, in the news, there are cops being shot left and right as well. So it's not just a one-sided deal. I mean, a lot of people forget, and I'm by no means trying to disavow or, you know, belittle the situation that goes on with race issues in law enforcement. And we know that that is a fact, that that does happen. But it's not like police aren't taking a lot of abuse, and good cops that aren't doing bad things are on the front lines every day facing dangerous situations and crimes. And some just sitting in their car being shot to death. This is a scary time to live in, Rod. You got to be thankful you're retired, I'm guessing.
I will tell you that a certain phrase comes to mind, and that is timing is everything. Mm-hmm. I retired in 2012 after 30 years, and I have to tell you, based on what we see nowadays, the assassination of police officers, the disrespect for law enforcement, while I enjoyed my career and it was a very honored and decorated career, mm-hmm. if you will. I was very proud of what I did over 30 years. I have to tell you, I'm glad to be done with it, if you will. And I can tell you my family is too.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. And yeah, this is a bizarre time, like I said, to be alive. And I think that's, you know, there are crime shows cropping up on every network right now. People are fascinated by crime on many different angles. You know, what's going on with law enforcement, what's going on with the judicial systems, because that's scary too. Do you ever watch as a police officer and you see some of these court cases go horribly wrong for the perpetrator where you're like, ooh, boy, I don't think this guy's innocent, but what's happening to him is not fair either?
Yeah, and that's true. That's true. You watch that every day on the news, and it's disconcerting, mm-hmm. but you have to understand also that what the news is reporting, there are other factors involved, and you're not getting the whole story. While you right. may think that you are, you're not getting the whole story. And there may be that one little factor that was involved, and I'm certainly not here to try to second guess anybody, because I've been in that situation. I've been second guessed, and it's not fun to be in that situation. But there's always one little thing that maybe the news isn't reporting, and that's what swayed a jury one way or the other.
I'm curious as your thoughts too. I have friends that are in the law enforcement business, if you will, that you know, the cops, attorneys, people from many different walks of life that are involved in law. One thing that I thought would start making, you know, it's harder to become a cop now. You know, I mean, you used to be able to just apply and you'd go through the training and you do this and you become a cop, and any thug could get in, really, if you just stuck with the classes and made your way through. So I could see that there would be more strong arming and issues. But you would think now with the education that you're required to have before you can even become a police officer, that this escalation of violence and misappropriation of power would actually de-escalate, but it seems to be increasing.
Well, I think that you're seeing a small fraction of the escalation. I think that there are safeguards being put into place, mm-hmm. that started years ago. And I'll give you an example. Years ago, the dash cam videos,
right,
became prevalent. And now you're seeing body cam footage every day. And I think that's a sort of a check and balance or a safety system that's put into place,
right,
not only to protect the citizens, but on the flip side of that, to protect the police. Because there's accusations made that aren't true. A lot of the time. And I can tell you, I never had the opportunity to wear a body camera. They weren't with our department by the time I retired.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you that the officers wear them every day now. And more often than not, an accusation will be made against an officer. And the next thing you know, the complaint is unfounded. Because they play back the dash cam video or they play back the body camera video, and it's made up.
How high are your stress levels? And we'll get to your story in a few minutes. I'm just, you know, get to talk to an officer who is actually out there on the front lines. And it's not like you went through easy times either. It's not like, well, I'm glad I got out in 2012 because it's hit the fan since. There's been a lot of violence escalating over the last 30, 40 years.
Oh, sure.
The police, when you watch a lot of those old dashboard cams, the dash cam footage, and I almost wish that they would air more of that footage of how many times things go horribly wrong for a police officer who's doing nothing but stopping somebody because of a taillight, and they get shot, they get hit by a car, they get accosted by the drunk driver and his passenger. I think people need to be reminded, and again, I know I'm going to take heat for this because, oh my God, I'm coming down on the side of law enforcement. But you talk about a high stress position. How high was your stress level as a cop every day? Were you nervous about going up just to, hey, can I check your ID and deal? I mean, was that an unnerving moment?
I can tell you, it got more unnerving the closer I got to retirement.
sure, we all see what happens in the movies, right? The new meat and the retired guys are always the first to go.
Yeah, you have to understand that I worked for a rural sheriff's department in Michigan.
Okay,
about 100,000 people in our county. 15 out of 16 townships were very rural. A lot of farmers, small towns, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that I didn't see my fair share of violence and things like that. But the stress level, I heard it once described as 99% of boredom. Police work is 99% of boredom, coupled with 1% sheer terror. And a lot of times that's the way it is, at least in the department that I work for. You take a city like Chicago or New York or L.A., or any major city, and I have to believe that the stress level is probably 100 times more than what I ever experienced. I was involved in a couple shootings. I was involved in, investigation of rapes, robberies, anything that you can imagine, stabbings, fatal accidents. I did all of our fatal accidents for years, and it gets to you eventually. It gets to you. It wears on you. And It's just, it's a fact of life. But I think the people that go into law enforcement, they expect that. And they're trained to deal with it, much more so nowadays than they used to be.
Really? So you think that there is better ways to deal with it now than you ever had in the past?
I think
dealing
that,
with the stress.
Exactly. I think that when I got out of law enforcement, the police academies and the law enforcement professionals during the police academies were training their cadets and their employees and their spouses on how to deal with stressful situations, so that they don't come home and they're, you know, they won't talk to their wife, you know, they take up drinking or whatever. They're trained to deal with that at the police academy level now in a lot of different places. And I think that helps tremendously.
Yeah, I hope that that continues. Do you think that's the big step to making things better? I mean, there's got to be a way to start bridging these gaps with relationships between law enforcement and the cities and the public that they serve. Because, there's a chasm that's grown and a distrust. I mean, it's always been there. You watch movies like, Straight Outta Compton, and you realize that the reality for some of us, you know, white middle America boys didn't have to deal with what urban street kids did and being abused for no reason other than the color of their skin. But that's always been a part of our world and probably sadly always will be. But do you think that there are some other major changes that need to take place in law enforcement to start to fix this chasm?
I think that they're already starting. I think that if you look at social media, and you look at, well, social media, I think, breeds hate and discontent a lot more than does feeling good, if you will. I think if you look at some of the news stories that come out now, in addition to the horror that you're seeing in the news, you're also seeing some good news. You're seeing police playing basketball when they get a call of loud kids playing in the street. They go and they join them in the basketball game. I don't know if you saw the clip right. The other day, the officers that got on the slip and slide and scooted down the slip and slide with the kids. You're seeing stuff like that, and I think that's building community relations. In addition to the hate that you're seeing, you're also seeing the good stuff through the social media too, and I think that helps. I really do.
All right, we're going to get into your book here, but you know I also do a paranormal show where we focus on the strange, and that's how you and I met through the paranormal world, right? And you gifted me a copy of your first book, kind of the Michigan version of Lizzie Borden that we covered on a past show. I have got to tell you, and I need to ask you a strange question here, Rod.
Okay.
The room you're in right now, this is a rare chance when we're Skyping and I'm actually talking, looking at you, you're looking at me. Most times it's just the audio that we run. Is there anybody in the room with you right now?
No.
Okay.
And let me tell you where I'm at.
Okay.
When I retired in 2012, uh-huh. About a year later, the sheriff's office called me back and they said, listen, we've got this office job. It's a grant-funded position, pushing grant paperwork part-time. Are you interested? Oh, sure.
Right.
So because I live out in the country, out in the middle of nowhere, internet service is here and there.
Very dodgy, sure.
I've come into work, and I'm at the Eaton County Sheriff's Office right now in Michigan in my office because there's uninterrupted internet service, and I didn't want our conversation broken up. So.
I appreciate that. Do you guys have any claims of paranormal at the office there, Rod?
I'm curious why you're asking. But
I'll explain in a second, Rod. I'm just curious. Does anybody ever talk about it, or do you guys keep that on the down low because you're cops and you can't sound like you're nuts?
Well, we don't like to sound like we're nuts, but I can tell you we do like to talk about the paranormal. Absolutely.
The reason I'm asking, and I don't know if you're seeing this as I'm seeing it on your screen, there have been a few times while you've been discussing this, when all of a sudden the screen goes black like somebody's walking in front of it, and I can see the large screen TV you have hanging up over your back shoulder, and I can see the reflection in it. Twice now, I've seen a figure walk in front of that as though, how do I say this so that the audience can understand? The person's not actually behind you. It's like they're in front of you and they're walking past, but it's catching the reflection in that TV screen.
Well,
so I've seen a figure walk past it twice as the whole screen dims, like there's a shadow moving through your room. So I don't mind make you nervous, Rod, but I don't think you're alone in that room right now.
Well, I got to tell you, that is interesting. I have the postage stamp size video of myself.
Right.
So it
might be good because I don't want you distracted during this interview, but I have seen something moving around in the room with you twice now.
Well, that's fascinating. I'll have to check out that.
I love that voice. Well, that's fascinating.
It doesn't bother me. It doesn't scare me at all.
Sure.
So.
Well, it's unnerving as hell to me when I'm trying to talk true crime and there's somebody walking around you in the room. All right. Good stuff. Let's talk about this. A Slayer Waits. The true story of a Michigan double murder. The book just released on June 24th. Take us back to September of 1955. What can you tell us about the area and where this story takes place?
Well, it occurred in Ingham County, about 30 miles from where I grew up. I can remember as a kid in the 1960s driving down the state highway. It was called M-52, but by the time I was aware of it. But back in 1955, it was called M-92. There was a major intersection with another state highway, M-36. There was a farmhouse that sat at that intersection with a barn. And across the street from that farmhouse was a small country general store. An elderly couple lived in the farmhouse. The gentleman that ran the store was a guy by the name of Harry Doesburg and his wife, Margaret. The people that lived in the farmhouse, their names were Howard and Myra Herrick. And they had grown children that had moved out, so they lived there by themselves. And Howard was a retired chicken farmer. So he had a big block of wood that he used to slay the chickens, if you will. Anyway, he had taken a part-time job at a small factory nearby. And south of Stockbridge, about 15 miles, is Jackson, Michigan, home to the world's largest walled prison, which at the time was the state prison of southern Michigan. And there was a trustee there by the name of Neely Buchanan. Mr. Buchanan was in prison for burglarizing a car dealership in Detroit. And he had gained trustee status at the prison. So he was actually housed outside the prison walls, and he was given the task of taking a prison truck and going around to local farms in the area, collecting garbage and bringing it back so they could feed the hogs that the prisoners were raising. So Mr. Buchanan applied for parole and was denied. And
well,
2 days
later, can I ask you real quickly, just so people understand, a trustee, what is a trustee?
A trustee is someone who's gained the respect, if you will, of the prison staff and is given menial tasks outside the prison walls and I guess inside the prison walls to do things because they are, for lack of a better term, trusted by the prison staff. If you go to any county jail, you'll see trustees that are outside working along the road, picking up trash or sweeping the hallways or doing menial tasks in the community.
So if you had a really dangerous background, you were a murderer, can you still can you still achieve trustee status?
I suspect not. I would say no.
Okay.
At the time, Neely Buchanan was not a convicted murderer. He was not a murderer. He had done an armed robbery a few years before. He'd been put in prison. He had been paroled. He then broke into a car dealership, was caught and resentenced to prison. Surprisingly, because he was a very likable person by all accounts, at least among the fellow prisoners and the prison staff, he had gained the trustee status, and so he was assigned to go out and pick up this trash. He left the prison after he was denied parole. He left the prison one morning to go pick up the trash, and he never came back. He got up to the small town
now,
of Stock.
I don't mean to keep interrupting you, but
it's okay.
Don't you think? And again, I'm not law enforcement, right? if you've got a trustee who's applied for parole and did not receive parole, might it be a good idea to kind of, I don't know, I'm thinking Cool Hand Luke, put him in the cooler for a little bit till he settles down. Maybe before you give him a chance to just go back out into the world and be driving around, and he just got denied parole, which is kind of like teasing an angry bear already, right? Might it have been a better idea for them to maybe hold off a few months before they let him back into trustee status?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I got to tell you, all the research that I did indicates that the prison staff thought, well, he took it very well, his parole denial. And they said, well, you're being denied parole. We're not going to let you reapply for two more years. He'd only been in prison at that point. He'd been returned to prison and had been there for 10 months when he applied for parole again. And quite frankly, I think it was just too soon, and that's why they denied it. Well, that's why they said, no, you can't have it, and you can't reapply for 2 years. So you're right. You're right. I would think that you wouldn't have maybe someone who's applied for parole, maybe as a trustee, but, you know, who knows? Back in 1955, things were a lot different than they were nowadays.
Right. Yeah, I just that's such an interesting facet of the story, right? That you're a trustee, somebody that you're a criminal, you're in jail, you're doing well. All right, you can have these tasks, but it's funny to think that they're letting criminals out of the jail area to do some of these tasks, and especially somebody that's been denied parole. If you didn't find them innocent or trusting enough to let them back out into the real world on a full-time basis, seems counterproductive to even let them out there on a part-time basis.
I would agree. I would agree totally.
Because that seems like a flight risk to me. All right. I'm sorry. I don't mean to digress. It's just that already seems like a hiccup in the system for me. But so he goes out after being denied parole again, goes out to do his trustee work, and never returns.
Correct. He drives up to the small town of Stockbridge in Ingham County. He runs out of gas with the prison truck, and he abandons it at the local high school. And he sets out on foot. About 8:30 that morning, the Ingham County Sheriff's Office gets a report of this abandoned prison truck. They go, quick call to the prison. They determine who had it. And they do, I guess, not a real well-planned search, if you will. They check the area. They don't find him. So they notify the local authorities, and that's pretty much it. In the meantime, Neely Buchanan is making his way through the fields and the woods, northbound along this M-92, if you will, for about 4 miles, and he comes across the Herrick farm. And he hunkers down in the barn for the night because he's tired. The next morning, he sees the farmer come out and get in the car. The car is parked inside the barn, and he decides he wants the keys to that car so he can further his escape. So he plans that when the farmer comes back later in the day, he's going to push this chopping block used to kill chickens. He's going to set it up on the rafters above where the car parks and push it down, knowing that it will kill the farmer. And he stated that in his confession. He knew it would kill the farmer if it hit him. So he waits for the farmer to come back.
Well, let's dig a little bit into the family now. This family that become the victims of this crime. What can you tell me about their lives and what it was like at that time for them?
Very simple. They were simple country folk.
Ma and Pa Ingalls kind of thing.
Exactly. If you can picture simple country folk in your mind, that's what they were. They had lived on that farm for a number of years. As a matter of fact, Mrs. Herrick actually had been born in that house. And once her parents had passed away, she and her husband moved back in there. They raised their family there. The kids had all grown and had moved out, so they were living there by themselves. Every Sunday, the family would come over, all the kids and the grandkids, and they would always have chicken dinner. A lot of times they'd have venison or beef. After dinner, Mr. and Mrs. Herrick would sit out on the porch with the family, and they would trade stories while the kids played out in the barn in the hay. Mm-hmm. And on the rope swing. And it was just a simple country life. And again, and I mention this because it comes into play in the story. Right across the street is a small country store where kids could go over and get candy, and they had you know, the essentials. They had gas there for people traveling along the state highway. Mm-hmm. It was just a nice rural setting. It was really quite quaint, if you will.
Did they have enemies? Were they problem people at all for town folk? Why do you think he picked of anybody? Why did he pick this barn to hold up in?
I think what happened, Dave, is that when he left the prison that morning, it was still dark out. He kept going through the fields and the woods until it got dark again. And he needed a place to bed down for the night. And he saw the barn, looked inside, saw the hay, figured, hey, good place to sleep. As he goes in, he sees a car inside the barn, figures, hey, I can get the keys to the car the next morning and further my escape. I think that's how that all came about.
So he had no connection to these people. He didn't know them.
No, absolutely not.
No grudge against them.
He was, and for the record, he was African American. Mm-hmm. And they were white. Ingham County, that particular area, largely a white population. And that came into play years later in this story, the fact that he was black and they were white.
Okay.
But beyond that.
So now he's found this. He sees the farmer take off. He decides to take this heavy wooden block used to kill the chickens. He's placed it up. He's going to give this thing a shove, drop it. I mean, we're talking Wile E. Coyote stuff here, dropping the anvil on the Roadrunner's head. And then he's going to take the keys. He didn't think any of he was just totally reserved with the fact that somebody's got to die today to get these keys.
Well, I don't think it was so much, I'm going to kill somebody to get these keys. It was, I'm going to get these keys.
Okay.
I mean, he knew what he was doing, right, and he knew it would kill the farmer, but I think he was more obsessed with just getting away. I don't think that he entered that barn initially saying, hey, somebody's going to die today, at least by the accounts that I have found. But he missed his opportunity. He missed his opportunity when he was sleeping and the farmer came back home and got into the house before he even realized it. So he waited. He had every opportunity to leave that barn and continue his escape on foot, but he waited until the next day.
And it never crossed his mind to try to B&E, break and enter, to just steal the keys and sneak in and out during the nighttime?
Apparently not. He did go into the house when they left at one time.
Okay.
To look around, but he didn't take any keys with him. I think there was probably only one set, but
gotcha.
He didn't take them, and so he went back to the barn and he waited for his next opportunity.
And was this Mayberry? I mean, were doors just left open? You didn't lock doors at this time?
You know, by all accounts, that's correct. I talked to a local guy here near where I live, and he said, I grew up in that area, and he said everybody left their doors unlocked. Mm. Everybody. And a lot of deals were made simply by a handshake. Neighbors, strangers were greeted with a handshake back
right then.
That all changed.
Was this a racially tense area or was it diverse? I mean, you know, meaning that the blacks and whites, there was no real issues. There might have been some underlying tension, but, you know, not an explosive atmosphere at that time for them.
I think the second part of that is more accurate, Dave. I think that it wasn't an explosive type of an atmosphere racially. Sure, there was racial tension going on. As a matter of fact, this particular murder took place at the same time that the Emmett Till murder took place. And if you know anything about that and how gruesome and how horrible that whole Emmett Till murder was. Emmett Till was a 14-year-old black boy that went down to Mississippi from Chicago to visit his uncle. And he was accused of whistling at a white woman in short, and he was kidnapped that night by the husband of the white woman and his cousin, and they tortured him and murdered him. And that really was the one of the forefronts for the civil rights movement, was the Emmett Till murder. But beyond that, getting back to your question, no, I don't think that there was an explosive racial situation. Sure, I think there was some racial things going on.
Right, because of the time and
exactly
and how it was back then. All right.
Exactly.
All right, so he's made his way in the house at one point while they're not there. He's kind of devised a plot in order to get these keys. Where do things start to heat up? How does this unfold for him?
Well, the next day, he missed his opportunity when Mr. Herrick came home with the car and pulled in the barn where he always did. Buchanan was sleeping and missed his opportunity. So he waited till the next day. The next day, Mr. Herrick left for work. That afternoon, Mr. Herrick returned home. He surprised Buchanan. Buchanan was bored. He was up moving around in the barn. He'd picked up a hand grinder that you would normally attach to a workbench to sharpen knives and such. And he had it in his hand when he looked up and Mr. Herrick was pulling into the barn. And so Mr. Herrick sees him, says, "Hey, what are you doing here?" And Buchanan says, "I was looking at your tools." And he says, "I wondered if you wanted to sell this." And as Mr. Herrick is getting out of his car, Buchanan clubs him with the hand grinder and knocks him out. And he starts to look for the keys. He starts.
So this guy doesn't start to, you know, you come into your garage, your barn, and there's just a black guy in your barn rifling through your stuff, and it's still very calm. He's very, "Hey, what are you doing in here? I was just wondering if you wanted to sell these tools." There's no thought process at this point of, "Hey, this doesn't seem like it's a good thing. I should get back in my car and get out of here."
Well, if there was, there's no way to tell.
Right.
I'm sure that Mr. Herrick, like anybody else, would go, "Hey, what the heck are you doing here?" Buchanan said in his confession, as he pulled in, he said, "Hey, what are you doing in my barn, or what are you doing in here?" And I told him, "Hey, I just wondered if you wanted to sell this." And as he stepped out of the car, Buchanan hit him with the grinder, and he fell, knocked him out. So he started going through his pockets, looking for his wallet, looking for the keys. About that time, Mrs. Herrick, who heard the commotion, walks into the barn and sees Buchanan going through her husband's pockets and her husband knocked out. So she screams, "What's going on in here?" And he grabs a ball peen hammer and commences to assault her.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And he ends up, she fends off his blows for a few minutes. The medical examiner or the coroner found bruising on her arms.
So
on
defensive
her
wounds, as though she was putting her arms up trying to block the blows.
Exactly.
Okay.
He finally connects to the point where he knocks her out. At that time, Mr. Herrick is getting back up. He's come to. He starts to get back up. Buchanan goes back over, gives him a final blow on the head, and kills him right there. Mrs. Herrick is still alive. Although she's unconscious, she lived for, I think they said, 4 to 8 hours afterward. But Buchanan grabs them, and he drags them into the hay and covers their bodies with bales of hay. So, just prior to Mr. Herrick getting to the barn, he stops at the little general store across the street, and like he does every Saturday. Mm-hmm. And he's going to get gas for his car. Harry Doesburg comes out. He's putting gas in the car. Mr. Herrick goes in, talks with Mrs. Doesburg for a few minutes. We're going up north tomorrow. He gets in his car. He drives literally across the street into a driveway, drives around the back into the barn, and parks the car. Mrs. Doesburg, a few minutes later, hears them screaming. She thinks it's their television.
Oh.
So she ignores the screams.
Wow.
And 2 days later, when the bodies were discovered, bloated and decaying in the barn under the hay bales, she realized that the screams that she had heard weren't their TV, was not their TV after all. It was them being bludgeoned to death. Very sad.
Yeah, very sad. All right. He bludgeons them. Where does he go? He just takes off?
He searches for the keys and he can't find them. Mr. Herrick had the keys in his hand, and when Neely clubbed him, they fell under the car some loose hay. So he never found the keys. He gets into the car. He pulls down the dash under the dash of the 52 DeSoto.
Sure.
And he leaves his fingerprints there, which are subsequently located by the police once they discover the murders. But he leaves the barn, and he hitchhikes up about 2 miles to another country store. There's actually two country stores about 2 miles apart in a small village called Millville. And he goes into the store. He asks about buses. No, you can't get a bus here. You'll have to hitchhike. So he grabs a ride over to Mason, Michigan, actually where the Ingham County Jail is located. It's the county seat. And he grabs a cab to Lansing, the state capital.
Now, he just murdered two people, Rod. Is he covered in brains and blood splatter?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I forgot to mention this. Every Saturday, Howard Herrick would bring home a new clean uniform from this factory that he worked at, and it was always on the front seat of his car. Buchanan saw that because Buchanan was about 6'1 and about 190 pounds, about the same size as Howard Herrick. So he shed his prison garb, which was now spattered in blood, threw it behind the hay bales, and put on Howard Herrick's uniform and hitchhiked up to the next town. He ends up actually in Lansing, using the money that he stole from the guy he just murdered,
right,
and grabs a bus to New York City.
Now, how long did you say it was? 2 or 3 days before the family was found?
Yeah, it was 2 days.
And how were they eventually found? What was the you know, catalyst to get somebody looking for them?
Well, their son came over on Sunday. They were killed Saturday afternoon, and their son came over on Sunday to get some eggs and found the house unlocked, which wasn't uncommon. But couldn't find them. Saw that the car was in the barn. Saw that their pet parakeet hadn't been fed. Noticed that the chickens hadn't been fed. And he figured, well, they must have had to run out somewhere with some friends. I'll get a hold of them tomorrow. So he comes back on Monday, discovers the same things that he discovered the previous day, and calls his brother who lives about 30 miles away and says, hey, something's not right. Mom and dad aren't here. Their car is here. The parakeet hasn't been fed. The chickens haven't been fed. And the other brother says, if mom didn't feed that parakeet, something's wrong because she loved that bird. So the brother is on the way over. He stops at the Ingham County Sheriff's Office on his way, tells the captain on duty, and the captain, who happens to know the couple, comes with them over to the farm, and they subsequently find him in the barn buried beneath the hay.
That's kind of fascinating. I mean, if you buried him beneath hay bales, you'd think that would have been a hard find for them. But I'm sure, was there a blood path that they were able to follow from the bludgeoning sites to where he dragged the bodies?
There was, but he was smart enough to cover that with loose hay.
Okay.
But the one brother went down to the lower level of the barn where the chickens were kept, and he noticed some blood dripping through the floor. And of course, after 2 days, I based this on personal experience, having dealt with several dead bodies in my career. After a couple days in oppressive heat, there's a particular odor.
Oh, sure. Right. Okay. That would have been easy to track and follow. Right.
But as they were searching the barn, he finds the blood dripping through. They go upstairs and start searching around, and they can see Mr. Herrick's knee and his arm protruding from under one of the hay bales, and that's how they were found.
Once they realize what they've got on their hands, how quick are they to connect this escaped prisoner with their bludgeoning?
Pretty quick.
So there was no other people in town that they questioned or thought might have had a hand in this?
No, they quickly found Buchanan's clothes hidden behind some hay bales. They already knew that he was escaped from the prison and that he had abandoned the truck 4 miles to the south. So they immediately suspected that it was him. Once the state police got there and lifted that fingerprint from the car, they knew Buchanan's fingerprints were on file. So they quickly matched those and they knew immediately, you know, within 24 hours who they were looking for.
Okay.
Yeah, it was pretty quick.
So fingerprint technology back in 55 was advanced enough that they were able to get that fingerprint and find matching prints for this guy that went missing. But like you said, they found his garb, his outfit, so they knew who they were dealing with.
Right.
All right.
Yeah.
So they start to spread out, I'm guessing, in a dragnet to try to find out where this guy is.
They do. They actually search that night. They start with Harry Doesburg's house, and they start interviewing people. And Doesburg refers them to the two guys that gave him a ride. They go to that guy's house. This is like at 2 or 3 in the morning. The police are showing up at these doors asking questions. They have a picture of Buchanan because they already suspected him in the truck deal where he abandoned it in Stockbridge. So they had a picture of him. They start showing the picture. Hey, is this the guy you gave the ride to? Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, they make a positive identification. So at that point, they know that he's been taken to Mason. But beyond that, they quickly learn that he made it to Lansing. But beyond that, they lose his trail. They don't know where he's at all. And the entire mid-Michigan area, and this is a chapter title in the book, falls under a fog of fear. They really do. I mean, nobody knows where he's at. He's killed two elderly people for nothing. And the entire area is petrified. Gun sales go through the roof. Locks are sold out. Ammunition is sold out. People are teaching their kids how to shoot guns. People are teaching their wives how to shoot guns. A very scary time in a rural mid-Michigan. Really
right, because
was.
Again, you go from Mayberry to, you know, the Bloodfields, and you realize that you're not that far from a prison. This can happen to anybody. And
exactly.
You're not even dealing with a – because, again – for people that might have forgotten, what was this killer's background? What was he in jail for to begin with?
Initially armed robbery and then just breaking and entering. But now he's elevated himself to the point where he's killed two people.
Right. But was he ever suspected of violent murder or something? No. This was a progressive escalation.
Correct.
Ooh. All right. And now the town, everybody in the area is freaked out. I mean, they don't know if this guy's still roaming around in their barns and their yards. They don't know what's going on, but it's better to be safe than sorry because fool us once, shame on you, right? And now they know this is going to be – they're going to arm themselves and make sure that this doesn't happen again in their sleepy little community.
Yeah, they had one elderly woman who actually put a revolver in her refrigerator thinking that if he broke into her house and wanted food, she'd offer to give it to him and reach into her refrigerator and grab the handgun and shoot him. That's how petrified people were.
Let's help us out here, though, okay? Because, you know, you say that and you think, you know, that's a pretty damn good idea. But there's some danger in putting your gun in the freezer or refrigerator.
I got to believe there is, yeah.
Yeah, because you don't want moisture building up in the chamber. And why? No. Why is that? Do you know? As I recall, and I don't have a whole lot of gun experience on this, but moisture in there can actually cause an explosion if it fires off improperly, correct?
You know, I got to tell you, after 30 years in law enforcement, I can't answer that. I don't know. I can tell you the moisture is going to rust your gun, though.
Yeah, well, the moisture is going to mess with your gun. Yeah, I don't do it, folks. Don't put it in and put it in a freezer bag because that doesn't make it any better. I just be careful because that can end up, I think that can do a lot more damage to you.
This is the disclaimer. Yeah. Don't try this at home.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in this day and age with conceal and carry rampant, I can't believe people are still stupid enough to break into homes as it is or break into areas because you just don't know. That's why you'll never see me joking around dressed as a Bigfoot walking in the woods. Well, that and the fact that I'm terrified of the out of doors. So, you wouldn't want to do that nowadays with everybody carrying a weapon of some sort. Okay, yeah. So now this the whole community is up in arms. They know what's going to do. people are finally locking their doors and acting differently. So it's really kind of a black mark in what was once a quaint little community.
Strangers are now looked upon with suspicion.
I bet.
Doors are locked all the time. The guy that I talked to near here, he's a local superintendent of the schools that grew up there. He said after that, he said, we left the keys in our Jeep out by the barn. That way, if escapee showed up, he was free to take it. He said that was always that way, just because of that murder.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yes. Life changed.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, my dad, in a weird sense as well, he's the kind of guy that always leaves the car unlocked. I'm like, lock your car. He goes, why? So they can break my windows and do more damage? If they're going to take something, they're going to take something. Just leave the damn car open and let them get in and out and not get more frustrated. So that's I understand that concept. Okay.
Yep. So
how long is he on the run at this point now?
Well, he's only been on the run 2 or 3 days.
Okay.
You know, but actually I take that back. The same day that he does the murders, mm-hmm. he makes it to Lansing that evening and he catches the bus to New York. So by the time the bodies are discovered, he's already begun his new life using the name of the guy that he killed, Howard Harris.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So he's in New York.
Back then, your ID did not have a photograph on it, right?
Exactly.
It was just an ID card with your name and address and stats. And because
right.
he was same physical build and makeup, you could probably pass it off a lot easier.
That's correct. And he also used a Howard's social security number.
Gotcha.
To get jobs and things.
Okay.
And so the one mistake that he made, though,
uh-huh.
was he sent his divorced wife a postcard from New York just saying, hey, I'm okay. And, of course, she turned it over to the police. And he's sitting in the house there in New York, and he hears a couple of the transients talking about how the police had coming in looking for some guy named Neely Buchanan. Well, they only knew him as Howard Herrick. So he decided, hey, I got to get out of here. So within a week, he grabs a bus and he wants to head down to South Carolina, but he's only got enough money to make it to Baltimore. So he goes to Baltimore and he gets a job there. The trail in Michigan has turned completely cold.
Okay.
Sightings are all over the place. None of them are substantiated, and the police come to a dead end.
And I've got to guess this is starting to build some racial tension, too. Because suddenly your bad guy is a black guy. You've got this people probably starting to look at black neighbors or strangers a lot more harshly than they did before.
I would think you're probably correct.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't touch on that in the book, but I believe that you're probably correct. I think it's only human nature.
Right.
As sad as that is.
Well, and especially in that time and era, and the fact that there probably weren't a whole lot of black neighbors in these areas, I would guess.
Actually, there was only two black people that lived in the immediate area where this murder occurred. They were farmhands.
I guess they didn't realize he was black, but they did. Law enforcement knew who they were looking for.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And a couple people had seen him hitchhiking.
Okay.
So
did they look into, and again, I don't mean to make this a racial situation, Rod, but did they talk to the black families in town to make sure that they weren't hiding him or weren't giving him aid in this situation?
Not that I was able to find out. No,
okay.
No, I don't believe so. I don't think so.
All right. So, dumbass, sends a postcard to his ex-wife, not even his current wife, not even somebody that might have his back.
Right.
He sent a postcard to the ex saying, hey, honey, don't worry. I'm okay.
Yeah.
And is she aware of what he's done?
Yeah. The police quickly zoomed in on her to see if he'd show up there.
Right.
So she was aware of what was going on. Well, she maintained that she didn't think he could ever hurt somebody or murder somebody. The police were convinced that he did. So the New York City Police Department shows up at the flop house where he's staying looking for him. Luckily, he wasn't there, I guess, for him. But back home, the police have hit a dead end. They don't know what to do. The trail has gone cold. Harry Dosberg, whose wife heard him getting killed, decides to raise a reward. And Harry Doesburg becomes single-handedly responsible for Neely Buchanan's capture. He raises a reward and spends a lot of his own money sending wanted posters around the country, buying ads in magazines and in newspapers. And he puts an ad in a magazine called Bronze Thrills, which is a magazine like a true crime magazine or a pulp fiction magazine.
Sure, okay.
Much like True Detective.
True Detective, right. That's exactly what I was thinking of. Okay.
But it's geared toward black people.
Oh, okay.
And he had the foresight to put that wanted poster in a magazine geared toward black people. And lo and behold, 13 months after the murder, some guy picks up his brand new copy of Bronze Thrills and he's looking through it and, holy smokes, I know that guy. I met him at the bar. 13 months.
13 months this guy stays on the lam.
Yeah.
Using this fake identity the whole time?
Exactly, yes.
What? Oh, God. Yeah. All right. Here's what's crazy to me again, and as a law enforcement official, I mean, I understand it's not today's society where you can Google or do these quick searches, but right. The fact that he's out there, a black man using the name of his victim, using that identity, how could he survive 13 months and somebody not put together, hey, you know, I read this news story about a guy named Rod Sadler who was killed and a black guy did it, and now I just met a black Rod Sadler. From the same area. That's kind of intriguing, right? You would think that lights would have been turning on for people.
You would think. And as a kind of an irony, too, he grabs a bus from Michigan to New York.
Right.
And they go through Canada. And the customs people back then, they question everybody going over there.
Sure.
Going through Canada. Where are you going? New York, what's your name? Howard Herrick. Okay, well, have a nice day, because there's no picture on that ID, and they don't know about the murder in Michigan. They know nothing about a double murder in Michigan.
Right.
So that's he makes it there, and he just blends in. He blends in.
Wow.
So 13 months later, right. The guy recognizes him. He flags down a couple coppers in Baltimore. They corner him in a candy store and say, hey, what's your name? What's Neely Buchanan say? Howard Herrick. They knew they had their guy because the guy saw the wanted ad and said, guys killed Howard and Myra Herrick. So when the police corner him, he says, yeah, my name's Howard Herrick. Oh. So they start putting, and he pulls out pay stubs from the paper company that he works for. It says Howard Herrick. So they said, you know, what are you doing? Where do you work? They start questioning him. And finally, Buchanan, he knows the gig is up. And he says, all right, I'll tell you. He says, you got me. He says, I escaped from prison in Michigan and for breaking and entering. Well, the cops knew that he'd murdered two people.
Right.
So they said, well, did you hurt anybody? Well, yeah, I did. So right there in this candy store, he confesses to the murder.
Unbelievable.
So this is where the story gets interesting, believe it or not.
No, I think it's been pretty interesting already, Rod. But, okay, where does this now take us?
Sheriff Barnes, the Ingham County Sheriff, is notified. He takes a reporter, he takes two deputies, and he takes Harry Doesburg with the reward money, and they fly to Baltimore. They're there the next morning. They pick up Buchanan. He says, I'm not going to fight extradition. I'm ready to put this behind me.
Okay.
I am back. He goes before the Justice of the Peace in Mason for his arraignment.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, nope, I don't want a preliminary examination. So the magistrate says, okay, we're going to forward your case to the circuit court. The next morning, he goes before the circuit court. He hears the charges against him. He says, I plead guilty to both murders, essentially. The judge says, okay. He says, we're going in the back room. Back in 1955,
mm-hmm.
it was a common practice for judges, at least here in Michigan, to determine if a confession was being given voluntarily without coercion or duress.
Gotcha. Okay.
To question the defendant alone, right, rather than big public courtroom.
Okay.
So the judge, Judge Solomon, takes him back to his chambers, mm-hmm, spends a couple minutes with him, comes back out and says, I believe that he's given this confession freely and without coercion, and I accept it, and we're going to have a hearing now to determine the degree of guilt. So Judge Solomon...
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. Again, not understanding legalese. The degree, yeah, of guilt. I've admitted I'm guilty. What do you mean? To what degree am I guilty? I'm either guilty or I'm not guilty. You're either pregnant or not pregnant. You're either dead or you're not dead. How is there a degree of guilt?
They called them the degree of guilt hearing. They were actually to determine the degree of murder.
Okay. Was it first degree, second degree, accidental, manslaughter? Yeah. So they're going to go with that. Okay. All right.
Yeah. So,
I'm only kind of guilty.
At the arraignment, the judge says to Neely Buchanan, he says, you have the right to have an attorney here.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want one but can't afford one, we'll provide one for you.
Gotcha.
Buchanan says nothing. The judge moves on. The judge doesn't say, do you want one? The judge moves on. Okay?
All right.
So he takes Buchanan back. Buchanan confesses to the murders to the judge. The judge comes out. They have the degree of murder hearing, the degree of guilt hearing. Buchanan never testifies. He's not represented by an attorney. The judge, after hearing testimony from the officers and the coroner, determines that it's first-degree murder. Buchanan sits there. The judge says, I hereby sentence you to 2 life terms in prison. So within 72 hours of Neely Buchanan's arrest in Baltimore, he has come back. He's been returned to Michigan. He's been arraigned in district court. He's waived extradition. He has been arraigned in circuit court. He's pled guilty in circuit court. They've had a degree of guilt hearing to determine the degree of murder,
mm-hmm,
and found that it was first degree. And he's been sentenced back to prison all within 72 hours. He's back in Jackson Prison.
That's the way court should be handled, right? Man, wouldn't it be great if you've got a guy that's willing to do it? Just put him. Okay, we're done.
Yeah, I'm going to say no.
No? Okay.
No. Several key issues came up down the road. Of course, the Herricks are dead.
Right.
And nothing's going to bring them back.
Right.
Neely Buchanan is living in prison as a life-termer,
sure,
if you will, lifer. And about 10 years after he sat there for a while, he begins to file appeals. And they are consistently denied by the lower courts. He comes up with this excuse. He comes up with that excuse. And they are consistently and every time denied. He finally gets a U.S. District Court judge to return the case to the lower courts. Now, this is the year 1981 now. Jump ahead 25 years. 1981. The case is returned to the lower courts for an evidentiary hearing to determine the degree of murder. Was it first degree? Was it second degree? Was it manslaughter? And for the first time in Neely's life, he has appointed an attorney to represent him. He's never, ever had an attorney appear in court for him. He had an attorney back appointed for him very briefly back in 1966 to initially file some paperwork, but that was it. So he now has an attorney because it's before the U.S. District Court, the Michigan Attorney General's office becomes involved. And they handled the case for the people. Accusations are made by Neely Buchanan that when Judge Solomon took him back to his chambers to determine whether or not his confession was being given freely or his guilty plea, that Judge Solomon referred to him using the N-word and that he better stick with his story and essentially threatened and coerced him into pleading guilty, and that became a huge, huge issue. Eventually, the case was going to be heard by the United States Supreme Court in 1984.
But, okay, here's where I'm confused. How is this... Boy, this is... got to be careful how I place this.
I understand.
What does it matter what name a person's called? They found his jumpsuit. They found his fingerprints. When they caught him and he admitted to everything freely and waived his own rights, what does it matter at that point? I mean, justice has been served in that case.
Well, essentially, the defense attorney was driving toward, hey, his guilty plea was coerced. He was forced to plead guilty because he was afraid, because he was the only black man, and he referred to himself in his testimony as, I was, quote, I was the onlyest black man in this community of white people. There was a large mob outside the jail. I felt threatened. I figured my family was going to get threatened, even though he didn't really have a family because his wife had divorced him years earlier. And so he was making all these accusations that he was being threatened and he felt threatened. And his attorney made the legal argument that a guilty plea cannot be accepted under duress or coercion. And then the case was made by the defense attorney that Judge Salmon had not, at the sentencing, offered him an attorney, which Judge Salmon didn't. But at the time, in 1955, that was not required. And Judge Salmon never asked him at his arraignment, would you like an attorney? There, all these little issues started to add up.
Okay. And I understand everybody gets their day in court and they should be represented fairly.
Sure. The state's position was, hey, he had 25 years to do this. He's had 30 years to do this. Why is he able to do it now? He sat in prison for 10 years before he even started to appeal.
Right. And how was he during that time? Was he working his way back into trustee status?
No.
No, he wasn't a model citizen at that point in prison time?
No, actually, he did become a model prisoner. Quite frankly, I interviewed his defense attorney, who's still a practicing attorney in Detroit. And I went and had lunch with him, and he said Neely Buchanan in 1984 was not the same Neely Buchanan that he was in 1955. And so when I interviewed the assistant attorney general who handled the case, I said, tell me about your first impressions of Neely Buchanan when you saw him in 1981. And he said he was almost grandfatherly. He was very quiet, very withdrawn, very just not what I expected to see.
Right.
And so his defense attorney was certain that Neely Buchanan was a changed man. Okay. And because all these little arguments that he had brought up, the case was actually going to be heard by the United States Supreme Court. And the Attorney General's office wanted that. They wanted the case heard because they felt there were issues that needed to be resolved. And so did the Herrick family. Daughter.
What needed to be resolved then? And especially from the Herricks, it seems like it's a pretty cut and dry case.
Well, they knew that Buchanan had killed their parents.
Right.
They wanted a resolution so that he could quit appealing. Wanted the United States Supreme Court to hear it and make a decision and put an end to it. While Buchanan was in prison in 1981, he developed colon cancer.
Okay.
Just short of the United States Supreme Court hearing the case, Buchanan died in prison. Literally months before it was to be heard.
All right.
And actually, Chief Justice Warren Burger actually opined on the case.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, a fascinating end to the case. And, you know, I asked Frank, or Frank Eamon was his defense attorney. I asked Frank, I said, what was your take on it? He said, the only takeaway I got from the case was that they didn't reverse the previous decisions they had made in the case. I asked Eric Egan, who was the assistant prosecuting attorney, I said, what was your take after he died? I said, was everybody excited? You know, ah, good, he's dead. We don't have to worry about it. He goes, no. He said there was no joy. In the same way with the Foreman family, he said the Foremans weren't the Herrick children. He said they weren't excited. They weren't happy. They wanted a resolution to this case, and they didn't get it. They didn't get it. Yeah, he was dead, and he'd never be able to appeal again. But they didn't get the resolution that they wanted.
I guess I still don't understand that aspect of it. You know, as the family, the survivors, I mean, there is resolution. They caught the right guy. They might not have gone about it in the most proficient legal manner, but the guy was caught, and they caught him with the ID, the information. He was using the name Social Security. There was no denying this guy's connection to this crime.
No question.
Right.
And quite frankly, I had a reporter ask me today. I did an interview with the local paper here in Lansing, and she asked the same thing. You know, they caught him with everything, and I said, I know, but that's how the Herrick children responded. I'm sure that probably some of them were, you know, happy that he was gone.
Right.
Their daughter, her name was Monnie. M-O-N-N-I-E, she wanted a resolution to the case, and she didn't get it. She didn't get it. Now, when we're done talking about this, before I forget, I don't know what kind of time frame you're on, but I've got a couple interesting coincidental stories that you are going to want to hear. No
Fire
doubt.
Off. Go ahead. Let's hear what happened.
Well, first, let me just – I'll close the story about the book with a couple. I had four copies of the book that I gave to people to sort of beta test read to see what their reaction would be before I had it published. And interestingly enough, I said, what'd you think? And they came back and they said, you know, you kind of felt sorry for Neely Buchanan in the end. And I was like, what? And they said, yeah. They said, after reading the book, in the end, when he passed away, you kind of felt sorry for him. Floored me. I did not expect that response.
Did you review it to make sure that you weren't making him too sympathetic a character? I mean, he was a killer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that's the response I got. Will the rest of the public see that? I don't know. But it was an interesting response that I got. So,
wow.
So, real quick,
and we will have a link up to the book so that you can find it and his original book. Give them the title of that name too.
I'm sorry?
Give them the title of your first book so that we can make sure they look for that, and we'll have a link up for it.
Oh, sure. The title of my first book is To Hell I Must Go. It's the true story of Michigan's own Lizzie Borden. And some people get confused by that subtitle. No, Lizzie Borden was not from Michigan. It's a woman who committed a crime very similar to the Borden murders.
Gotcha.
And so that's where that subtitle comes from.
All right. All right. So you had a couple of weird sideline stories here. Let's go.
Real quick. And my wife is going to kill me for telling this story. But she
wanted. Well, at least we've got it on record, officer. So if it happens, we know who the perpetrator is.
Perfect. We live on 9 acres out in the country, and she'll deny this, but she wanted a flagpole. And so I said, okay, where do you want it? She said, I don't want it in the front yard. I want to be able to see it from the deck and the road.
Right.
And I said, okay, you tell me where you want it. She said, I want it right here. So I go out with my post hole diggers, which dig an 8-inch hole, and begin to dig and promptly rupture the propane line leading to the house. I'll shorten the story. They send a repair guy out from Marshall, which is about 12 miles south of us. We live southwest of Lansing near Olivet. And they send this repair guy out, and I'm telling him about a school teacher that I had and that accidentally blew up his house fixing a gas leak. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, I remember that happening. And so I asked him, I said, well, where are you from? And he said, Stockbridge. Stockbridge is kind of near Williamston. And I said, oh, I said, what a coincidence. I'm writing a book about a double murder in Stockbridge in 1955. And he looked up at me. He was down digging in the dirt. He looked up at me and he said, escape convict? And I looked at him kind of like, yeah. And he goes, my uncle owned that grocery store across the street.
No kidding.
He said he bought the house after the murder. I've been in and out of that house 1,000 times. We used to play in the barn. He said, you need to talk to my mom. She'll remember everything. Dave, what are the chances of that?
Synchronicity. Holy cow.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was a little floored by that.
Right.
And one day I just said, I'm going to go find the Herricks grave. They're buried. I know they're buried over in this small town of Dansville near Mason. So I drive over there and I pull in the cemetery and I immediately realize the mistake I've made that I am not going to be able to find their grave. There's like 10,000 people buried there. So I drive to the back. I said, this is useless. Well, there's a truck stop there. So I stop and I get out and the guy's working on a headstone. And I said, hey, I said, do you work here? He said, no. He said, I work for a monument company. I'm just putting an armed services plaque on a grave. And I said, oh, I'm looking for a elderly couple that were murdered in 1955. And he said, well, what's their name? And I said, Herrick. And he looks down at the plaque that he's holding, and it's their son. He's putting the armed services plaque on their son's grave.
Wow.
The sons that found him in the barn.
No kidding.
Because their grave's right there. You parked right in front of it. And I had no, because the foliage in front of the plants, yeah. I never saw.
Unbelievable.
What are the chances of that happening?
Yeah, that's crazy. Very strange synchronicities.
I got to tell you, there's some strange stuff going on. But the book, A Slayer Waits, it's a true story of a double murder in Michigan. It's sort of, I like to describe it as a Law and Order episode in print. It begins with the murder. It ends with the legal process.
Very cool. Rod, it is a pleasure, and I hope that you'll visit us again. Are you hot on the trail of another story?
I am. It'll be a couple years, but yeah, and don't ask because I'm not at liberty to tell you what it's about right now.
Okay. I'm guessing true crime in Michigan?
It'll be true crime in Michigan. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll talk to you then. Rod, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story. It's always a pleasure, and I appreciate you taking time at the beginning of the show to kind of give us a policeman's perspective on what's going on in the world of law enforcement. So thank you for doing that as well.
My pleasure, Dave, and congratulations again, sir.
Thank you so much. And all right, well, Tim, it's time. We've got to take a look at what's been going on in the world around us this week because people love it, and we do too. It's time for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. All right, Tim, it's time to open the case files of more Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. And boy, do we have some doozies this week. Boy, I don't even know where to begin with this one. Let's go straight out of Florida, Tim. Just
all
like,
right.
NWA, we're straight out of Florida, where a man has hid his wife's body in a freezer to collect Social Security. Sun City Center, Florida. Authorities in Florida say the heirs of a man who hid his wife's body in a freezer so he could continue collecting her Social Security benefits have repaid the government for the money he took. The U.S. Attorney's Office said in a news release, the heirs sold Alan Dunn's condo in Sun City Center, a retirement community south of Tampa, and paid $15,743 to the Social Security Administration. Prosecutors say Margaret Dunn died at home in 2002. Alan Dunn hid her body in the freezer. He then collected her Social Security benefits until he died in 2010. Following his death, authorities learned Dunn's wife was dead. The heirs, who didn't know Dunn had hidden his wife's body, agreed to waive their right to inherit the condo, and instead they sold it. How is it their problem to pay back $15,000? Your heirs are screwed to pay your bills?
As a matter of fact, they are.
That's nuts.
Yeah, and it
but here's the weird thing. So from 2002 when she died to 2010 when he died, that's 8 years. He only collected $15,000 from Social Security for her.
Yeah.
Wow. That's not a whole lot of money. That makes me a little sad, Tim.
Yeah.
All right. You know, Tim, sometimes in life, one job is just not enough. We need a little extra income. We
Tell
need
me
to
about
find
it.
A way to just make things happen and bring a couple more dollars in.
Yeah.
Well, a former U.S. Postal Service worker is facing federal prison after she admitted she took cash bribes in exchange for delivering packages that she knew contained drugs. Evelyn Ramona Price, 53, of Deerfield Beach, said she illegally redirected several packages on her Boca Raton delivery route over a period of about 5 months last year. She lost her job as a mail carrier in October when authorities said they discovered she was breaking the law. Tim, breaking the law.
Breaking the law.
On Friday, she pleaded guilty to bribery of a public official. The offense carries a maximum punishment of 15 years in prison and a fine of $250,000, though Price will likely receive a lesser penalty when she is sentenced in September. Price told investigators she met a man she knew only as Steve. You just can't trust Steve's, Tim. Uh-oh, here comes Steve. She met him in June of 2016, and she agreed to provide him with addresses on her route where packages could be sent. The man would call her on the morning of the packages were due to arrive at the post office and arrange a meeting place for her to deliver the packages to him, according to court records. He gave her $50 per package when she dropped them off to him, either at a local supermarket or veterinary office, she said. Price said she was never told what the packages contained, but told investigators, I figured it was some kind of drugs, but I didn't know what type of drugs. She said, because it's all about ignorance, Tim, as long as I didn't know what kind, I'm okay. It could have been chewable Flintstone vitamins, as far as she knew.
Or horse tranquilizers. You never know.
She said she received the last, or at least one to two packages per month. Well, that's not much. $100? All that? You risk your life for $100?
Yeah.
Starting in June of 2016, she was able to recognize the packages because they always looked the same and were addressed in the same handwriting. On October 27th, Price intended to deliver four packages to the man, but he called off their meeting that morning and told her something was not right, she said. After she finished her deliveries and returned to the post office, Price was questioned by investigators and admitted what she had been doing. Authorities seized the four packages, which they said contained a total of more than 20 pounds of marijuana. The packages bore return addresses in Florida or Brooklyn, New York, but were postmarked from California. Price has remained free on $50,000 bond since she surrendered in April. At the time, she said her mail carrier job had paid about $800 a week, but she lost her job in late October after she was questioned about the packages. $800 a week as a mail carrier?
Yeah.
I'm in the wrong damn business.
I'm telling you.
What the hell?
Plus, you had that extra sweet $100 a month. For right. the illegal drug carrier.
You know, now, it would be one thing if you're like, oh, you want me to do this two or three times a day? Oh, sure. You're making an extra $150. Then I can understand breaking the law, Tim.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, but $100 a month. Yeah.
$100 a month. That just seems really stupid.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, all of it's stupid. You don't do that, but holy cow. Yeah. Well, here's a change, Tim. We're going to Enid, Oklahoma, where three people are now charged in connection to a burglary of an Enid car wash early Monday morning. Carissa, Jeffrey, and Mark were arrested Monday afternoon at the Days Inn Hotel at 2818 South Van Buren after police received a call from the owner of the burglarized car wash. The cameras were a good investment, said Matt Ruggs, who owns the 81 car wash and the adjacent storage facility and sheet metal building company. They're paying off. Ruggs says after he filed a police report about the burglary Monday morning, he decided to take a second look at his surveillance video to see if he could spot any identifying features of the suspects or their SUV, to see if there's anything on this car that maybe we can recognize out there on the streets, Ruggs said. And we found a missing hubcap. A missing hubcap on the front passenger side wheel. And when Ruggs says began repairing some of his cameras broken in the burglary, he looked across the street at Dollar General. And sure enough, here they are. Sheer luck that was excellent. Ruggs says he followed the SUV and the suspects where they eventually were spotted at a nearby hotel. He had watched the surveillance video from the business and spotted the SUV at a Days Inn on South Van Buren, called and said, yeah, I just spotted the car from the video that broke into our business, said Sergeant Nick John, an Enid Police Department detective. When police arrived at the hotel less than a mile south of Rugg's car wash, they met Baltz, Miller, and White in a second-floor hotel room. Three individuals came out, spoke to the officers, went to do some more investigating, and the individuals left the hotel room. And when officers asked them to stop, one of the subjects actually ran away. Miller was arrested by police a short time after he ran away, John said. Baltz and White were also taken into custody. The police searched the hotel room, and they found nearly 100 pounds of quarters, totaling about $1,800, as well as some items purchased at a store. More quarters and a number of miscellaneous tools were found when police searched the vehicle. 100 pounds of quarters, Tim.
Jeez.
Yeah. Got a little change in my pocket going jang-a-lang-a-lang.
It's a lot of games of Q-bert.
Yeah, what? Q-bert? Holy weird reference. So we believe that the hotel room was obviously purchased with some of that money, and then the items in the hotel room, said John. The hotel room was paid for in cash, but it was only minutes after the burglary was committed that the hotel room was rented. So they broke into the place, drove across the street to stay at that hotel. Miller, Baltz, and White were charged Thursday with second-degree burglary, concealing stolen property, and possession of burglary tools. Miller was also charged with resisting arrest. Ruggs says he's still counting the cost of the damage to his car wash business and surveillance cameras, but says he's happy with the outcome. You know what feels good about all this, Tim?
What's that?
He's helping the guy down the road, Ruggs said. They would have gotten away with this if it weren't for those kids and their damn dog. It would have just happened again. So he's doing his time, Tim, helping to break the law down himself.
There you go.
Florida man skips out on a $6 bar tab and tells cops he's a sovereign citizen, Tim.
Oh, of course.
That's a new one. A Florida man allegedly skipped out on a $6 bar tab about getting out of jail is going to cost him a few $1,000s. What? I got to hear more of this. This is crazy.
Oh, yes.
Kevin Charles Conklin, 54, was arrested on the 4th of July after Lady Lake police were called to a restaurant in Lady Lake, WKMG reported. When officers got to Margarita Republic, Conklin was making profane statements to customers and wouldn't pay his tab, according to the Village News. Conklin jumped an officer's car and he chipped an officer's front tooth while resisting arrest. Okay, there it makes sense. I was going to say, you're kidding. Hundreds of dollars for skipping out on a $6 drink? Conklin reportedly informed the officer that he is a sovereign citizen and did nothing wrong, according to WKMG. Conklin faces numerous charges, including disorderly intoxication and two counts of petty theft. He's a charmer, too.
Yeah?
Yeah, if you could imagine Jimmy Buffett strung out on heroin and then dragged for 4 miles behind a herd of horses, that's kind of how this guy looks.
Really?
We're going to go to Dearborn, Michigan, Tim. We're leaving Florida alone for just a little bit because, believe it or not, crimes do happen elsewhere, Tim, okay? Stop being so racist about Florida all the time. My God.
I love me some stereotypes, though.
Dearborn police are seeking a bald man who stole 7 boxes of what, Tim?
Frosted Flakes. Because he's in Michigan. That's where they make them.
Is that your final answer?
Yeah, that'll be my final answer.
Dearborn police are seeking a bald man who stole 7 boxes of the hair growth product Rogaine. The Dearborn Police Department is asking for the public's assistance in identifying the suspect responsible for this crime, as it is suspected he will continue committing this type of crime as 12 to 14 months of consistent use is needed to see results. That's what a press release joked about from the police department sent out today. The man wore an Air Force dad t-shirt during the robbery at 3:30 p.m. June 22nd at a pharmacy on Warren near Wyoming, according to police. Employees told the police that the man, who is between 30 and 40 years old, entered the store, selected 7 boxes of Rogaine. He then put the Rogaine in a shopping bag, exited the store, and entered an older model Chevrolet. He was last seen heading east on Warren Avenue. While this is not the most hair-raising crime, according to this article, we must protect our retailers as these crimes drive up the retail costs for honest consumers, Dearborn Police Chief Ronald Hadid said. Anyone with information, better speak up. You can call the Dearborn Police, Tim, at 313-943-2241 or Crime Stoppers at 800-SPEAK-UP. Don't sit back and wait, folks. Call in if you know where the bald bandit is, the Rogaine Renegade. We need to bring him in.
rumor has it he stopped the growth of the community.
God, this is turning into a hairy situation. Hey, police in Florida said a man caught driving a stolen forklift told officers he was just tired of walking. And this wasn't his first time. Port Orange police said an officer approached Bradley Barefoot, 43, who was appropriately barefoot at the time after spotting him with the stolen forklift. There was a male parked in a handicapped spot with a piece of heavy equipment that had a mattress on it. The male was barefoot talking to himself while swearing and throwing his hands up, WKMG-TV quoted the Port Orange police report as saying. Barefoot initially told the officer he took the forklift because he thought it was the same one that had been stolen from his boss in Alabama. But he later said he took the $38,000 vehicle because he was tired of walking and he noticed the keys had been left in the ignition. Barefoot was arrested on a charge of grand theft. Police said the incident wasn't Barefoot's first offense. He was arrested in April 2016 when he took a forklift from behind a Best Buy store in Daytona Beach and used it to move some boxes before driving the piece of equipment to a Bob Evans restaurant. Damn, they do have some good sausage, though, right?
Oh, they do.
Oh, you're like in the middle of stealing stuff, and all of a sudden you get that mouth watering for Bob Evans sausage, and you just got to pull over, Tim, and go eat. Investigators said Barefoot told them in 2016 case that he took the forklift because he just didn't feel like walking, Tim. A guy named Barefoot didn't feel like walking.
Well, you know, blisters, Dave.
Isn't it ironic? Don't you think?
Yeah.
A little too ironic, Tim. Okay, this guy. A drug dealer who was busted with a van described as full to the brim with weed tried to convince police that it was all for him.
Oh, well,
we talked about this, didn't we? Shane Prosser, 50, had hundreds of pounds worth of cannabis in his van. It was busted when passing traffic cops, and they noticed the stench. Oh, so it was the good stuff. Right?
Yeah.
Isn't it the stinkier the weed, the better the feed?
Well, so I hear,
Yeah, the drug-dealing driver and his passenger claimed that they had just bought the cannabis and were going to use it for their own personal use. Police also found a key to a nearby farm. The farm in Coitrahan, Bridgend, South Wales, turned out to be the site of Prosser's substantial cannabis-growing factory, Tim. Prosser denied producing cannabis in possession with an intent to supply, but was found guilty at Cardiff Crown Court. Prosser from Carew, near Bridgend, was jailed for 2 years and 8 months. Detective Sergeant Curse Lake from South Wales Police said, "Our officer saw straight through his lies, and thankfully, so did the jury."
Funny enough, the amount of weed in that van is also known as Snoop Dogg's daily delivery.
Really?
So, yeah, it's just a small amount.
That is a full van brimmed with weed.
Yeah.
Nope, this is just for us. We're not selling it. We're not distributing it. Me and my buddy Tim, we just, you know what happened? We bought stock in Cheetos, and they paid dividends in 42,000 cases, and we got to get through them, and this is the only way we knew how.
No, well, yeah. I mean,
Florida man sits on gun, shoots himself in the penis, police say.
Ow!
Oh, Jacksonville, Florida, I love you. A Jacksonville man accidentally shot himself in the penis early Friday morning when he sat on a gun in the driver's seat of his car. The 38-year-old man was taken to Memorial Hospital by a woman who told police that the man was sitting in his Nissan Altima by himself and came into their home on Freedom Crossing Trail in a panic and ran straight to the bathroom. She said she followed him and saw he had a gunshot wound to the penis. So she took him to the hospital where he underwent surgery. She said the man told her he sat on the gun, which accidentally went off.
Yo.
Boy, if I had a dollar for every time I went off accidentally. Police were, I'm talking guns, Tim. Police were called to the hospital just before 3 a.m. because of the gunshot wound. Investigators found that the man was convicted of cocaine possession in 2004. It's possible he will be facing charges for possessing a firearm because he is a convicted felon. And I don't think cock hunting is in season.
No. Funny enough.
Yeah, good God. I need help, Tim. I just need help. That's what it comes down to. Polk County, Florida needs help, too, Tim, as well, because Polk County deputies are looking for two men dressed like women who are accused of strong-arm robbery at a Home Depot.
They call it the Bosom Buddies burglary.
That could be it. Do you think maybe they're not really men dressed like women? They accidentally shot their penises off, and this is the only way they can make money?
I think so, yeah.
Suspects are 18-year-old Omar McCray and 19-year-old Malik Taylor. On June 22nd, deputies say that the two men, along with another unidentified person, committed retail theft at Lakeland Home Depot on South Florida Avenue, stealing hundreds of dollars worth of gift cards. Officials say they became aggressive when confronted by store personnel, then left. I thought the gift cards don't work till you ring them in, and then they have to, like, activate them.
You know, some of them now you don't even have to activate them, but most of them I thought
like
you
you're
did.
You're asking for trouble, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they kind of asked for it then, too, I got to say.
Yeah.
On July 6th, the same suspects went into the Winter Haven Home Depot on 8th and again attempted to steal gift cards, according to deputies. Video shows McCray putting a 69-year-old clerk in a chokehold while the unidentified person scanned and activated the cards. There you go. Warrants are out for the two men in Polk County, and they're described as men who dress as women. They each have criminal histories in Hillsborough County, including 60 previous felonies from Taylor. Anyone with information on their whereabouts is asked to call Crime Stoppers at 1-800-226-TIPS, Tim. TIPS, T-I-P-S.
Oh, TIPS.
Yeah, 1-800-226-TIPS.
Well, I figured they were dressed as women, so I...
Well, we're going to go around the outside, round the outside, round the outside for this next story, Tim. We were talking about penis shooting off. Now we're going to go to Florida woman found with meth in her buttocks area.
Well, of course.
Court documents from a Florida county claim a 30-year-old woman was trying to chew meth that was hidden in the woman's buttocks area.
Ooh.
During a strip search at a county detention facility.
So
she pulled it out of her ass.
Wow.
And then tried to eat it. According to documents obtained from the Collier County Clerk of the Circuit Court website, holy cow, that's a lot of C's, Summer Nicole Adamson is facing charges of alleged drug possession, alleged possession of drug paraphernalia, alleged evidence tampering, and alleged smuggling of contraband into county detention facility. The incident, according to court documents, took place on June 29th when units with the Collier County Sheriff's Office were called out for an incident where the caller's car window was broken. When the units arrived at the scene, the caller described the suspect as a woman named Summer and that she had left in a Jeep. A short time later, a corporal saw the vehicle in question with a female driving the car. The corporal, according to court documents, recognized the driver as Adamson from a previous law enforcement contact. The car reportedly had expired tags, and the corporal pulled Adamson over. Adamson, according to documents, was seen digging in the car's center console, and a corporal who approached the car saw a syringe poking out of her right leg as she was sitting on it, as well as a small plastic baggie with a brown powder, which Adamson later told corporals on scene that it contained the big H, Tim, the white horse.
Oh, geez.
Mm-hmm. Heroin.
Yeah.
Oh. Adamson, according to court documents, was later placed under arrest, was taken to the Naples Jail Center. At the jail center, deputies who were conducting a strip search of Adamson saw her reach. Oh, God. At the jail center, deputies who were conducting a strip search of Adamson saw her reach in her buttocks area and grab a small plastic bag. Adamson reportedly placed the bag in her mouth and started to chew it.
God.
The deputies were reportedly able to remove the baggie from Adamson's mouth. Field testing showed the bag contained meth.
Yeah.
Do you think she pulled it out and said, "Hey, what is this shit?" crack is whack, kids. According to court documents, Adamson is scheduled to be arraigned on July 24th. If she gets free, Tim, I'm giving her your phone number, 612.
No, what?
Well, Tim, she's going to be in the mood for a little love and affection, and I thought you'd be the kind of guy to help her out with that.
She might have a little yuck mouth, Dave. I think we're fine. Yeah.
God. She just pulled it out of the pooper and started chewing on it. First of all, what does meth do to you if you eat it? I can't guess a full package of meth is good for anybody.
I think she was just trying not to get caught with it. But then think about it. That's twice recycled, Dave, if she does happen to re-exit it.
Oh, my God. Twice recycled. Why do you do these things to me, Tim?
I'm just saying, you know.
Dimmy, why do you do this to me, Dimmy?
She walleted it once.
Oh,
and then, you know, she's... you know, hoping that the bag will be enough.
Listen, kids, this is a public service announcement from your friends at Beyond the Darkness, Darkness Radio and True Crime Tuesday. Please, if for any other reason you're looking to quit drugs, realize most of them have been up the ass of some kind of nasty criminal at some point, Tim.
Oh, my.
And it's important for our listeners to realize that you don't need that in your life. You don't need ass crack. You don't need melon meth.
Not only do they go to fund terrorism, they might give you a staph infection.
Oh, my God. Is that how you got yours, Tim?
Huh? No.
Is there something you want to tell me about, Tim?
It might have been my doctor. Yeah. Because it happened on the operating table.
Likely story, my friend. Likely story. Were you storing meth in that hole in your foot?
Maybe my surgeon had a little meth up the crack. Maybe I need to talk to him.
Yeah, you might want to. All right, well, that's it for today, folks. Oh, God, I hope you enjoyed True Crime Tuesday, and Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals will be back with you next week with another brand new edition of True Crime Tuesday.